Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Hoseng and Joseph Lowndes, who are going to talk to us about Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race, and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. This book was published in 2019 by the University of Minnesota Press, and it's a really interesting investigation and unpacking of understandings around precarity and particularly our understandings of race when we think about questions of precarity in the United States and elsewhere, but centering mostly in the United States. But I'm going to let Dan and Joe talk to us a bit about that. First, I'd like to introduce our two authors, Dan Hoseng and Joe Lowndes, to the New Books Network and to ask them each to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this project.
Thanks, Lily, so much for having us and facilitating this conversation. We started this project right after the 2010 midterm elections. We had noticed this really significant uptick in attacks against public sector or government unions, which are still mostly white workers, white, blue, and white collar workers, and particularly around these discourses of dependency and what we called, and what others have called parasitism, namely that these government workers were becoming a drain on the productive and hardworking labor of society, especially private sector workers. I'm trained as an ethnic studies scholar, and I formerly held an appointment in the political science department at the University of Oregon with my colleague, Joe. So we were really interested in these questions of the interpretations of that were being assigned, the meanings that were assigned to these subjects, and the ways they connected with longstanding racialized tropes about dependency that had really been associated in particular with women of color in general, Black women in particular. So why was it that white workers were suddenly being subject to this kind of new round of both stigmatization and blame? And that's kind of what started the project, for both of us.
Yeah, I think what Dan said captures the origin stories of the project. I think also we were interested in seeing how, you know, in 2010, it was abundantly clear 2 years after the Great Recession that we were in what scholars were beginning to call the Second Gilded Age. And so we were curious, as scholars who both work on questions of race and class, what happens to, racial identifications and their uses in politics in conditions that are changing economically. And, you know, in the case of the U.S., the kind of widening gulf between the very rich and everyone else. I'm a political scientist at the University of Oregon, and my work is primarily on right-wing politics, on racial politics, on social movements, and partly on U.S. presidential and party politics.
And so the book itself sort of dives in the beginning to sort of unpack the frameworks that you are talking about. This question of the Second Gilded Age, the Great Recession in 2009 and 2010, the sort of accumulation of wealth within a very small group, in particular within the society. But you also talk about, as you say in the book, the new analytical frames for understanding the relationship between race, class, and state institutions as well. Can you talk a little bit about both the sort of braiding together, but also the unpacking that you've done throughout this book of looking at this question of class and race within our understanding, particularly the economic understanding of how these have often toggled together and also sort of been analyzed separately?
Well, I think Joe and I have both thought in our respective work a lot about whiteness, particularly in the mid to late 20th century, and the scholarship on it in revealing and demonstrating the ways that whiteness provides a certain kind of guarantee or social insurance against forms of economic and social precarity and instability. And certainly that's the long story of New Deal social redistribution programs, unemployment insurance, Social Security, etc. What we're struck by in the most recent downturn is that given the kind of continued upward redistribution of resources, so the intensifying of the 1%, left growing numbers of people who think of themselves as white, newly at risk for forms of economic crisis, social crisis. And so we're trying to think about how to both take those shifts seriously without imagining that they suggest somehow the dissolution of longstanding racial hierarchies. That is, how could whiteness still matter? How could inherited scripts of racial domination still matter? And at the same time, we could also take seriously the kind of movement of millions of people, white working and middle class people in particular, who never thought they were going to be subject to these forms of precarity and vulnerability. And we're now facing those. So those are some of the kind of like intellectual histories and genealogies we were trying to think through, and some of the conjunctures that raise those questions for us.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a flip side to this that we try to explore in the book, which is that in the post-civil rights era, let's say, questions of the meanings of race, of anti-racism, of multiculturalism have become kind of up for grabs or available to different kinds of uses. And so partly what we track is the way in which languages of multiculturalism, let's say, get used by people promoting kind of corporate visions or neoliberal visions of politics in the U.S. so that Blackness becomes something that is mobilized not on behalf of social justice movements, let's say, or redistribution, but as a mark of kind of a new kind of Horatio Alger story. It kind of through the right, or particularly the Republican Party, has used figures like Herman Cain or Ben Carson or other Black figures who talk about their humble origins or ghetto origins or the ways in which they have come out of particularly difficult circumstances because of their Blackness, having overcome that and become successful, not as a critique of a racist society, but as an endorsement of the liberating possibilities of capitalism, that you could become, that these are success stories, which show that the market works so well that even forms of racial domination historically can be overcome by capitalism, can be overcome by hard work, individualism, entrepreneurship, et cetera. So those are kind of on the one side, it's kind of like the partly what Dan is beginning to refer to as kind of a kind of a re-racialization of certain white people who are dropping off the bottom. And on the other hand, a kind of symbolic, partly cynical use of civil rights discourse or multicultural discourse to really advance, you know, certain kinds of conservative economic agendas.
And we should add to this that, I mean, this in no way disturbs the absolutely longstanding, unequal, racialized distributions of wealth, status, power, life and death. So, and really since the Great Recession, those have only heightened. So we're trying to simultaneously think about a number of contradictions. How is it that at least a small number of figures of color in general and Black electeds in particular are being valorized as neoliberal stalwarts, while growing numbers of white workers are facing new forms of precarity and longstanding racial hierarchies are becoming more entrenched? And we had some sense that the kind of prevailing notions to sort this out either as a matter of class or race were inadequate to try to grapple with these contradictions.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about next, is this, is the terminology that you use, racial transposition. And this is part of, I think, what is framing a lot of what you're looking at as these sort of contradictions that are taking place, and an understanding that race itself, we think about, you know, is a color of a person's skin, but that what you're talking about, as you noted, are these scripts, that the way that we sort of contextualize our understanding of things. Can you talk a little bit about the term and how you use it within your research and the analysis in the book?
So we take racial scripts from the historian and ethnic studies scholar Natalia Molina's work. And there's a scripts really refers to the narratives or meanings assigned to race. And I think importantly, it doesn't actually, we're not talking about people's, some notion of their empirical positioning within the social hierarchy. So we're not talking about people losing their racial identity in any sense, or that it's not becoming salient. But a notion of scripts works through the understanding that race is always a relational phenomenon, that we don't understand the meaning of Blackness, of course, apart from whiteness, but that racial meanings are co-produced between and among different groups. And they're going to be subject to the forces, different forces at play in any particular moment. So to go back to the example of public sector workers, when, you know, anti-statist conservatives are trying to think about how do they stigmatize, and, you know, these longstanding public sector workers, they're teachers, they're toll booth collectors, state workers, municipal workers, who never would have thought of themselves as kind of authors of a global economic crisis or somehow not pulling their weight. How do you make that legible to people in ways that will allow for a certain kind of public consent to take away protections and resources from those workers? And what we're struck by is to narrate the fact that they were somehow not deserving of remuneration, that to undermine their pay and benefits would be to the benefit of the rest of the public, they turned on these scripts of dependency, kind of laziness, gluttony, that have always been racially associated with Black and brown people in general, and Black and brown women in particular. So if we think about debates over welfare dependence or immigrants as dependent, so these scripts that had long justified their abandonment, attacks on welfare, attacks on benefits and status for immigrants, were now available to be brought to bear on essentially a largely white workforce. And again, it doesn't mean that these workers are, their whiteness is, they're losing it in any sense, but it does mean that the scripts available in one context could be brought to bear to justify their abandonment in another context.
Yeah, I think Dan covered it there.
Okay. I just wanted to ask you about this one sort of quote that I was really intrigued by, that I think really elucidates what you're talking about in the introduction, where you note that Barack Obama's political rise exemplified these dual modalities, as he was represented as both a fantasized racial threat to American national identity and as the clearest evidence of national redemption and exceptionalism. And you sort of note that he's, you know, you're not spending a lot of time talking about Barack Obama, but that he has this kind of, he is drawn in a variety of ways, highlighting the kind of contradictions that you're talking about. Can you talk a little bit as we sort of move into the other chapters of the book that sort of look at the sort of role of African-Americans? You have a whole chapter where you're talking about the Republican African-Americans or conservative African-Americans. Can you talk a little bit about what you see in these kind of contradictions?
I mean, on one sense, what we see here with the example of Obama is a certain kind of quite familiar and longstanding trope of, you know, what Afro-pessimists would call abjection, and a sense that Blackness itself resides outside the boundaries of the populace, the civic good of humanity itself. And we can think about the kind of caricatures of Obama, the extremely virulently racist ones as doing that kind of work. But we also think about the ways that Obama's Blackness becomes incorporated into kind of exemplifying and demonstrating the exceptional qualities of American civic nationalism, and that it's possible for it then to work in both those registers, both as abjection and as something that reveals the kind of very special and singular character of American political culture. So we partly reference that then as we talk about the kind of ascendancy of a certain and a relatively small group of Black conservatives.
Yeah, there aren't a lot.
Right. And we're not making any claims about a kind of whole scale or even meaningful shift in kind of broad Black political behavior opinion. But we are asking how has it come to be that someone like Tim Scott, the Republican senator from South Carolina, can stand in as the most authentic exemplar of Tea Party and libertarian conservative politics, not in a way that's deployed just to disavow racial animus or intent, but to argue that Scott, through his own narrative of uplift, his celebration of free market principles, social conservatism, militarism, nationalism, represents the kind of purest realization of the American dream in ways that seem far more authentic than someone like Mitt Romney. And that can happen while we can also acknowledge the intensification of state violence against Black communities, the prison industrial complex as well. They can work in both registers.
I think that's right. And, you know, it's not only does it work in both registers, it really shows kind of an open availability of these discourses, you know, for what Obama represents to or represented to, say, Democratic voters generally could be, you know, something different for different constituencies. Partly, you know, an historic civil rights victory, partly the idea that he, you know, in his great showing in the Iowa caucuses in 2008, he says that night, they said this day would never come. They said we would never get this far. And he never says exactly who the they is. Partly it's meant clearly to draw on you know, the idea that the civil rights movement has finally arrived at a certain place. In the same way, at the Democratic Convention that year, there was a, you know, an I Have a Dream Day on the day that Obama spoke at the convention in Denver that year. And so partly it's about the uses of civil rights as kind of an affective strategy, as opposed to directly drawing on specifically what civil rights organizations or the movement or specific figures we're calling for in concrete ways. And so, you know, partly it's about that, and partly it's about the ways in which, as Dan said, Obama represents a kind of civic nationalism, a kind of redemptive character for American politics overall, which is something which really goes across the spectrum, not just across Democratic voters, but among Republicans as well. And, you know, and there's a way in which that kind of strategy is one that's picked up by Republican elites who want to use figures like, say, Tim Scott or Alan West or others to make a case for a particular kind of American exceptionalism, even as the very policies that they are promoting will be policies that will fall hardest on Black and brown people.
And so I wanted to take you back. I mean, I know this is sort of the chapter that falls in the middle of the book in terms of the sort of incorporation of conservative African-Americans. But you start out the sort of the book talking about parasites of government, racialized anti-statism and white producerism. And then, of course, move into the sort of poor white America. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about those two chapters and what you're sort of getting at in terms of understanding the role of white workers and what's sort of changing and shifting in that sort of context.
Producerism, other scholars have written about producerism as a kind of longstanding from the 19th century trope in U.S. political culture, and the way it authorizes a certain claim to civic participation, to sovereignty, to not being subjected to the most trenchant forms of exploitation. And there had long been this association between whiteness and producerism, that whiteness, oftentimes was understood to be coextensive with producerism. To be white meant you were autonomous, independent, not needing to rely on the labor and redistributions of other people's work. Partly what we're trying to get at in the second chapter in particular is, and then by contrast, I should say that parasitism, the notion of dependence, had often been highly racialized. And certainly through the mid-20th century, one can argue those are pretty stable assignments and forms of meaning. Again, what we're trying to pick up on is in the wake of not just the Great Recession, but really since the kind of widening forms of economic inequality, beginning in the early 1970s, that claims to whiteness no longer will authorize a producerist identity. And when you can't claim a producerist subjectivity in a society where your very claims to kind of membership, citizenship, belonging, and standing rely on that. That's what then makes you subject to broad forms of precarity and abandonment.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it historically, the Republican strategy in the 1960s and 70s and 80s was to try to draw white working class people, white working and middle class people out of the Democratic, out of the New Deal Democratic order. They try to make place for union members, poor whites, others, by saying, like, look, we are now the party that represents you. We don't represent you necessarily on the basis of class position as such, but in contrast to African Americans, Latinos, other ethnic minorities, there's a gendered component to this, which is clear as well, an appeal to certain kinds of masculinity. But part of the idea was that the Republican Party says, now we'll represent white people generally, kind of broadly. This was Nixon's silent majority, or middle America, or forgotten Americans. And the idea was that these people, they will all be kind of taken care of within this Republican fold. And so here we are, half century later, where whites are not taken care of in the ways that they were in the kind of the New Deal and post-New Deal era. Many whites have fallen kind of off the bottom. They don't longer have the same kinds of protections, labor protections, union protections. There's been decades of stagnant or declining wages. There's been the erosion of other forms of public provision, which have made it that you have whites who are failing by the standards of a capitalist society. So what do Republicans do then, or what do conservatives do then for this population that they work so hard to bring over onto the Republican side of the ledger. Well, part of it is we look at conservative writers like Kevin Williamson at National Review or people like Charles Murray, who begin to refer to poor white people in kind of a newly racialized language, a re-racialized language of that depict them, these whites, as now socially and culturally disorganized, even in Charles Murray's case, genetically incapable in certain respects. Languages that have been reserved for black and brown people is now being deployed against white people at the bottom in a way that is used to justify kind of a new economic order, which has left a lot of people out. Again, as we strive to say over and over in the book, that white people have not suffered in the way that black and brown people have by any index, but relatively there's been decline, which many researchers and scholars have pointed out. But so our question is partly what happens then, what kind of identity shifts are going on when whiteness becomes is made vulnerable in these ways, and what kind of languages and discourses are being deployed to describe these folks, and also how people themselves are responding, to these kind of new conditions.
And you spend a lot of time in the chapter on white precarity, the new racialization of white precarity. You delve deeply into a lot of the sort of popular discussions of what's going on with regard to opioid crises, what's going on with regard to unemployment, and questions about masculinity, that this is a sort of new understanding, but it's not necessarily new understanding of people who are living in a very economically precarious situation. This time they are white, but they've also long been white, right?
Right. I think what's new is this notion that they are fully culpable and the authors of their own failures and despair. And again, this question in these cultural registers of, think about J.D. Vance's, really, really popular book, is about, his own life and about kind of the crisis in an area of Appalachia that's absolutely racialized as white, that it's a cultural failure. It's a failure of behavioral norms. It's a failure of family formation. It's a failure of self-discipline. And again, those scripts and tropes that had long justified the abandonment of other groups were now easily ready to explain the dynamics that he's writing about, Vance and others. And of course, what that disappears is a whole set of structural conditions, of upward redistributions, forms of intensifying exploitation. We can really see this in the context of the opioid crisis and what social demographers have called white deaths of despair, where in some cohorts, you have white middle-aged people without a college education dying at higher rates than their black and brown counterparts. We certainly never would have seen that kind of inverted disparity in the kind of long post-war era. And the question is not that in this kind of new colorblind moment, it's only class that matters, but instead to think about the ways that longstanding forms of racial demonization were paradoxically available brought to bear to explain, this intense suffering and death, even in the kind of heartland of Republican support.
And so I wanted to next move to the chapter, The Brown Brother for Donald Trump, The Multiculturalism of the Far Right. And you have an interesting sort of take on our thinking in terms of multiculturalism. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw in this research around issues in terms of multiculturalism and how it also sort of became part of the narrative of critique from the right?
Here we're building on the work of scholars who describe a kind of neoliberal multiculturalism, the ways that representations of racial difference, plurality, diversity, have been taken up certainly in all across corporate America. So we can think about all forms of marketing, but also, you know, internal diversity offices, the ways that Fortune 500 companies have mastered a certain language of diversity and inclusion. So we've argued that if, you know, corporate America, other mainstream institutions, the U.S. military have figured out how to make use of racial diversity to legitimate their own standing and kind of ethical bearing, we shouldn't be surprised when even figures on the far right also come to understand that those kinds of incorporations and representations have payoff for them also, and that they can figure out ways, if the U.S. military can figure out how it can articulate and connect images and representations of racial difference to strengthening, you know, military and colonial practice, then we shouldn't be surprised, again, that even figures on the far right might also think about that as well.
Although I should say, I think that we were a little surprised. You know, we were writing this book long before Trump was elected. And in some ways, it seemed that, you know, particularly in the Republican primaries, that there was this kind of revolt of this, you know, the actual, you know, white forgotten Americans of, you know, that we had been discussing, that these were the folks who felt shut out by kind of neoliberal elites were all in for Trump across the primaries against Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or any of these other candidates who were more establishment candidates in some ways. But so it seemed like in some ways, like, okay, this is going to be a reassertion of white supremacy with bared teeth in a clear way, which of course it was in the Trump campaign, both in the primaries and in the general election, and of course his presidency itself. But it was then there a surprise to see that kind of a, you know, kind of pro-Trump forces in the streets, in organizations like the Proud Boys or other kind of social formations who were organized partly around attacking anti-racist or anti-fascist activists or immigrant rights activists or others, would show elements of multiculturalism even in their own rhetoric or discourse. So that, you know, so there was in a way that you know, people kept describing in any article you'd see, and even among left journalists or even among anti-racist activists, a continual description of groups like the Proud Boys, these other kind of like street fighting far right groups, as white supremacists, as white nationalists. And it was increasingly clear that that was not an accurate description of a lot of these, you know, people in these organizations. But not only that, it was not an accurate description of even the leadership itself. So here in Oregon or up in Portland, there was a group called Patriot Prayer, which is kind of connected to white supremacist groups and connected to extraordinary street violence and even, you know, the murders of Jeremy Christian, a white supremacist on the Max train. Even there, where you had this kind of open white supremacy, there was still this kind of odd multicultural language and identification happening. The leader of Patriot Prayer, Joey Gibson, he's half Japanese and identifies as non-white. Kind of number two lieutenant in that organization, a guy named Tiny Toesi, is Samoan. And doesn't identify as white. And then there's other folks in that formation there, and in the Proud Boys more generally, where you have not only you know, kind of mixed race, you know, formations, but the uses of language and symbolism of civil rights or of multiculturalism even within these organizations. And so partly, you know, we interviewed Joey Gibson and talked to him about this. And he told us that his heroes were Martin Luther King and the student activists in the Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins. And, you know, this kind of mixture of kind of a hodgepodge of kind of civil rights imagery and figures in kind of his far right political vision.
And so what you're talking about, in not just the individuals who are involved in some of these organizations that many of us kind of classify or think about as being white supremacist or alt-right, is that there's also a strange scrambling, as you sort of talk about throughout the book, of our understanding of who we think is inhabiting some of these organizations or doing some of this kind of advocacy, and then who's actually involved in it. I think this is also, a demonstration of what you say, this kind of tension that we're seeing in terms of class descriptors and racial descriptors and nationalistic descriptors as well. Can you talk a little bit about that, particularly with regard to the final couple of chapters in the book and state abandonment and the militia revolt?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just on that point, on the one hand, it's absolutely true that the base and the overwhelming majority of people that are supporting the groups Joe is describing on the far right are white, they're men. It's a very kind of masculinist, patriarchal space formation in politics. But when we continue then to see men of color in particular, but even some women of color in leadership roles, you know, usually the dominant understanding we have is either they're kind of fronts or they're somehow kind of brainwashed, that there's no way that they could reconcile their own racial identities, a recognition of U.S. racial subordination, and the embrace of far-right politics. And what we're seeing in these groups is actually, it's certainly true that these groups are filled with their own kind of contradictions, but that there's an effort underway to do just that, to think about the ways that the forms of patriarchy, militarism, strong opposition to reproductive rights could be joined with a certain politics of racial uplift, and even, as strange as it sounds, anti-racism. At least from their perspective, these groups see themselves as engaged in a certain kind of anti-racism. And the reason I think that matters towards our last chapter is we're trying to make the argument that these identities in this moment of crisis are actually much more open than we might initially think about and than they might seem. So we kind of critique a certain tendency to describe the current moment of entrenched political conflict as just based on, you know, the kind of the language of political tribes, that you simply have identity-based groups that are fully coherent, self-contained, they're already realized in their interests, battling out, you know, the coasts versus the heartland for the soul of the nation. And I think what the multiculturalism of the far right, what some of the occupiers who took over a bird sanctuary in early 2015, these were militia groups that took over a federal wildlife refuge in eastern Oregon to protest kind of the, you know, what they described as overreaching federal power. We're on the one hand, those are militia groups with far right anti-statist politics, but there's an interesting way that their anti-statism converges with actually longstanding anti-statism among groups of color, even on the left, that talk about the way that kind of abuses of state power. Now, the militia groups can't imagine a resolution to that other than a return to kind of white producerism, the kind of abolition of the state or certainly its marginalization. But we make the argument actually that if they really want to attend to the forms of precarity and uncertainty and crisis they're facing, even white communities in places like Eastern and Southern Oregon, they're experiencing really significant levels of unemployment, poverty, they actually could identify with and imagine and join, the kind of cutting edge racial justice formations in the country, groups like Black Lives Matter. So that there is an openness to these forms of political identification that we haven't witnessed, before the last 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And partly what we want to argue is that the language of producer and parasite, the language of, you know, people who are the, you know, kind of autonomous and independent figures, individual figures in, of American American political imagination, will necessarily, you know, make it much harder to find forms of collective action to challenge the you know, the structures that cause all this suffering. So in the case of Eastern and Southern Oregon, you know, that there is, if people are, the timber industry has abandoned these people, the federal government has abandoned these people, the tax structure of Oregon has abandoned these people. There, I don't think that there's a lot of people in the, you know, wealthy areas of Multnomah County who are terribly concerned about what's going on in Douglas County or Josephine County or Harney County in Oregon. These are outlying rural areas. But partly the people in these areas where there is suffering, they will blame, you know, the Bureau of Land Management for their problem, because they see them as standing in the way of their ability to act as kind of, you know, settler pioneers who can graze and ranch and mine on their own. But of course, it was never the case that these people were individual, you know, frontiers men and women who did not have state support. I mean, the first state support, of course, is wiping out the Nez Perce and the other tribes that are here that make the way for white settler culture to begin with. But the other thing is that these folks were, you know, imagining this kind of crossing over the Rocky Mountains and covered wagons as a kind of like heroic story of self-fulfillment. It doesn't allow them to think about the possibility of how they might work together and how they might work with other people in collectively solving problems and collectively figuring out why resources aren't distributed their way, why they can't farm or ranch or mine the way that they once did. So partly what we want to say is that it's elements of kind of ideological whiteness, maybe we could say, that stand in the way of the possibility of joining other struggles that could begin to ameliorate some of the suffering and maybe, you know, transform some of the most destructive elements of modern capitalism, which, you know, ultimately we argue that are at the heart of a lot of these problems.
And that's also not where a lot of the attention is directed in terms of what you've found as, you know, in sort of exploring these different sort of case studies, is that it's often not exploring what's the problem with capitalism. It's more of what's the problem with the state, or what's the problem with, you know, sort of other people being unable to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, partly what we want to say then, therefore, if you're able to turn it, I mean, the state is a problem too. And of course, the state is made up of a panoply of institutions, which aren't always, or sometimes at odds with each other. But if you were to think about where is the shared ground between Eastern Oregon and Ferguson, Missouri, and Flint, Michigan, and the U.S.-Mexican border, you might find that, you know, certainly white people have a very different experience than people of color in other areas, but we think that there is shared ground in what it means to have both state predation and state abandonment and capital predation, and what the possibilities might look like if we were to imagine these things differently.
Yeah. And just, you know, to add to that, I mean, those links, you know, there's a certain kind of reductionist politics which argues, well, what you have to do is efface or ignore the very different conditions in all of those places between Ferguson and Flint, Eastern Oregon, the border. And that's not our argument at all. But we're arguing for a politics that takes those differences quite seriously, but also thinks about how there are available genealogies of critique and resistance that foreground the role of the state, that foreground the role of capitalism and the kind of intensification of class power in ways that could link them together, and that they're not somehow hermeneutically sealed off from one another, nor are the underlying causes of their conditions altogether different.
And I wanted to ask you, because you start out the book in a really interesting way, which is surprising to the reader, in telling the initial story that you do about Joey Gibson. Is that correct? And I was curious, as you were doing the work and sort of delving into the research, what was it that you found most surprising in terms of the thesis that you were building and what you saw as you were doing the research?
I think in particular, you know, we had this interview with Joey Gibson, on the one hand, right in the middle as Patriot Prayer, his group, was engaging in these very confrontational, often violent protests with both, you know, some forces on the left, but also like a whole range of just progressive groups and ideas in general. And on the other hand, we heard Gibson then talking about the scourge of mass incarceration, kind of trying to articulate some distance from the most focused kinds of nativist politics. He really had a critique of, you know, capitalism in some ways. And it's certainly less that whether he was sympathetic or not, and more that, you know, this kind of key figure on the right is trying to assimilate and take in different political traditions and identities and orientations in ways that I think struck us as quite dynamic and formidable. And it left us with the feeling that if our only kind of response to that is, you're a white nationalist and unredeemed, or you're just trying to cloak it, which is on the one hand not true, but the notion that that's all there is to their politics and that they're not themselves also trying to think about the contradictions and spaces and incorporations they might make, we will actually underestimate how formidable they can be. And I think the kind of common sense, or one more familiar way to think about it is, you know, the kind of after Trump's election in 2016, even among his most vociferous critics, people acknowledging, well, there were people in my family, people I knew, others who I didn't think would be drawn to those politics who indeed were. So I think this is an open question about taking seriously the kind of dynamism of conservative and in some ways far-right politics today, so that we can offer, a more compelling and generative alternative.
Yeah, I would say I think that everything that Dan said is right. And in terms of what was surprising, I think we found surprises all the way through. In each one of our case studies, you know, we and partly I think it might have been the lens that we were using to look through it, but, you know, to see, for instance, you know, militia supporters working briefly with Black Lives Matter activists around a police bill in Portland, or the use of the term Rural Lives Matter as a way of kind of, a form of identification, maybe partly meant ironically, but also as identification in that context, or, you know, the real language of at best condescending language used by people at National Review or Charles Murray to describe the white poor, it was quite surprising to us. So I think, we kept finding these ways in which both race and class were mobilized and moved around in odd kind of combinations to do different kinds of work, and kinds of work that actually that mattered politically, that had concrete effects in the world, to see it over and over and kind of continually realize how open and fluid some of this stuff is. And then, you know, which kept challenging us to think like, well, what do we make of this? What's going on? How do we theorize this? How do we frame this even? And what kind of analysis can we offer in the face of all this. And I'm not sure we actually fully achieve that in the book, because partly I think it is more open than we can even quite come to terms with. But I think what we meant most of all then finally with this is to, maybe orient us to the surprising nature of politics in this moment around these things.
I mean, that's what I found to be interesting in the conclusive sort of way. The book is not necessarily conclusive. And I thought that was interesting in terms of opening up considerations and rethinking some of the sort of, as you say, the labels and the categories that we often shift and sort political activities into as well. So I wanted to ask each of you, Dan and Joe, what are you working on now? And perhaps you'll come and talk to me again about your new projects.
I'm working on a book called A Wider Type of Freedom, Reimagining Racial Justice, which is laying out in kind of theory, method, and practice histories of racial justice that imagined and fought for broad-scale, systematic transformation. So they didn't just want incorporation into the state, into the market, into military, but they had much more universal bearings and visions for social transformation. So it's a short teaching book, trying to make visible to students, especially a history of racial justice politics that's less ameliorative and incorporative and more about broad-scale transformation.
Fascinating. Joe?
I'm working on a book on kind of a political history of right-wing populism in the U.S. since the 1960s, partly both inside of electoral politics and outside, from kind of white supremacist organizations to insurgencies in the Republican Party to the ways in which some of the stuff also infected the Democratic Party, say in the 1990s. So it's kind of a walk through from the kind of the Wallace campaigns, the George Wallace's campaigns, the late 1960s, through the Buchanan campaigns through the early 1990s to Trump's election 2016. So it's partly about a series of insurrections within the Republican Party. Partly it's about broader changes and how people are imagining American majoritarianism or an American middle. So that's one project. Dan and I, of course, are continually hatching new ideas for joint projects as well, which is probably too soon to talk about. But.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope that each of you or both of you together, when you hatch that new project and get it going, will come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk to me about them. Today, I'm talking to Daniel Hosing and Joseph Louds about Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race, and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity, published in 2019 by the University of Minnesota Press. Gentlemen, where might somebody pick up a copy of your book?
Well, if you're in the Northwest, we know you can get it at Powell's, the Landmark bookstore in downtown Portland.
It's awesome. Press, yeah. And of course, the University of Minnesota Press website, I assume.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And other places as well. Yeah. We won't mention them.
We hope it'll get into more brick and mortar stores as time goes on, but we'll see, I guess.
I wanted to thank you, Dan and Joe, for being with me today and for talking about Producers, Parasites, and Patriots.
Thank you so much for having us, and thanks for your great questions, Lily.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Lily.